Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. For the next 45 minutes or an hour or so, I'll be taking you through recent developments in the public safety labor environment. This is our first podcast of 2019. I really would have loved to have had at least a couple of cases ready for you to go that had the date 2019, but we're only 3 days into the year, so unfortunately I can't do that. I do have some housekeeping issues, though, that I want to take care of before I get into the month's cases. And the cases this month are, I've got three of them that are really pretty juicy cases. We have one out of Cleveland involving the termination of one of the officers involved in the Tamir Rice shooting. We have another case from Nebraska involving body cameras and the negotiability of body cameras. And then we have a very good, I think, very illustrative case out of Michigan involving the duty of fair representation and what it means and what it doesn't mean. But before I get there, the housekeeping. We've done a couple of surveys, asked you guys to participate in a couple of surveys as of late. One has been on the podcast and the other has been on our seminars. And we've made some internal decisions about both of those issues. First of all, let's talk about the podcast. Overwhelmingly, we got the response that you wanted more content on the podcast. And by more content, what you advocated for is that we do a second podcast sometime during the month, that we have two podcasts that would be a little bit shorter than these monthly ones that I'm doing right now, and that in the second podcast of the month, that we emphasize different things, like we might emphasize a particular topic rather than a case, or we might do interviews with different people and have those be the focus of that second podcast. So here's what we've decided. We've decided to do that. We're going to have two podcasts. We're going to have our usual First Thursday podcast, and then just because we can, we're going to have a third Thursday podcast. And that second podcast, the third Thursday podcast, that second podcast, we are going to devote to things like special topics, or maybe there's a late-breaking case, and I'm going to make a much better effort at interviewing people. And I've got some people I've already lined up to do interviews. They're going to be pretty interesting interviews, I think. I'm going to be interviewing one of the country's leading Fair Labor Standards Act lawyers on what are the pressure points under the FLSA today. I'm going to interview an arbitrator, somebody who is the former head of the very prestigious National Academy of Arbitrators. I'm going to ask her what I think of as the five questions that all of us want to ask arbitrators and put her on the spot with respect to that. There's a blockbuster promotions case out of the New Orleans Fire Department where the fire department had basically gone to what I think of as a rule of the list, where if you took the test and you basically had a pulse, then the fire chief, or as they call him there in New Orleans, the fire commissioner, could pick anybody on the list. And this is a lawsuit challenging that. And the Louisiana Court of Appeals just ruled that that violates all sorts of different laws and ordered that 30-some-odd firefighters who'd been passed over in promotions to the rank of captain who had higher scores than the people who were promoted, that those 30-some-odd firefighters should be promoted. At any rate, I'm going to talk to the lawyer who handled that case in the Louisiana Court of Appeals. We're going to talk about a variety of different things, what it's like in a non-union state to be dealing with issues like promotions, and what is it exactly that that promotional process ran afoul of. So at any rate, I've got a bunch of these interviews and others that I'm lining up, and we've got some special topics. So I think this new version of the podcast, which we're going to start in February, I think it's going to be fun, and I think we are going to get a lot more content out there. Now, it comes at a price. Not a huge price, but comes at a price, but it's a price that gets you a lot of stuff. First of all, our standard old First Thursday podcasts, the ones that we release on the first Thursday of every month, they're going to continue to be free. We're not going to charge for those. It's never our intention to charge for them. What we are going to do is have a premium podcast subscription level, and it's going to get you a bundle of stuff. And the bundle of stuff that it will get you is that second podcast that we do every month, plus any other podcasts that we'll put out. So, for example, I put one out the day the Janus decision came down. Those podcasts you would have access to. Also, this will give you searchable PDF versions of five different books that we have published in LRIS. And the books are The Rights of Law Enforcement Officers book, The Rights of Firefighters book, Public Safety Collective Bargaining, the Fair Labor Standards Act, and then a book on the Family and Medical Leave Act. You'll get, without any additional charge, searchable PDF versions of those books. In addition, you'll be able to get a printable PDF version of our monthly newsletter. This is a newsletter that we charge a fair amount for. We put it out once a month. It's usually 12 pages long. I discuss about 18 different cases in each newsletter. This bundle will include a printable version, a PDF version of the newsletter. And also you'll get a 5% discount on seminar registrations and book orders. And all of that is going to cost you $99 a year or $9.50 a month. A bargain at half the price, right? Or twice the price, I guess I should be saying. So that's the model we're going to. We're going to get more content out there. It's going to take a fair amount more work. That's one of the reasons that we're charging. But we're giving a lot more here to people as well. We're giving, I think, the access to the books alone, I think, is going to be pretty significant. You can find out about all this by going to our website, LRIS.com, and you'll see links for premium podcast subscriptions and be able to sign up for all of that. Now let's talk seminars. A lot of you responded with comments on our questions about where should we be holding seminars and what should the content of the seminars be. If you recall, I mentioned in a prior podcast that we had almost by default ended up holding all of our seminars in Las Vegas, that it was something I wasn't really completely comfortable with. I wanted to hold them in various places around the country. But the problem was that public safety employees and their lawyers and HR reps love to go to Las Vegas more than any other city in the country. And, of course, because we're putting on the seminars, we wanted to go where most people wanted to go. Well, we're going to try again because there was a great deal of interest in us having at least one seminar a year at some other location. We asked for preferences with respect to location, and we got three that kind of were separated from the rest, from the pack, in terms of maybe a fourth, in terms of the number of votes for them. The three that were up there were Fort Lauderdale, Florida, Nashville, Tennessee, and one of the big casinos, mega casinos in Connecticut. The fourth that was just kind of knocking on the door was Boston. Well, once upon a time, we did hold seminars at in Connecticut at the casinos there. They're wonderful facilities, and people seem to like the seminars. So that's going to be our first effort. We're going to set a seminar there, probably set it in the latter part of 2019 or perhaps early 2020. Going to put a seminar in place there and get the word out. And hopefully this will make it much more convenient for people to come to LRIS seminars. Thanks to everybody for participating in the survey. And now with no more ado, I will get into the cases. Let's start with the Cleveland case. I think everybody knows a little bit of the background of the Tamir Rice shooting. It occurred on November 22nd of 2014. Two Cleveland police officers were dispatched to a call about a man with a gun. It ended up with one of the officers, Timothy Lohman, firing two shots and killing 12-year-old Tamir Rice, who was holding a replica pistol. There was tremendous media attention, both national and local. There were visits to Cleveland paid by the U.S. Attorney General. There's a criminal investigation by the Cuyahoga County Sheriff's Office and the Prosecutor's Office in the county, as well as the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation and Identification. When all of that was said and done, the grand jury issued a no true bill finding that basically exonerated Lohman, who was the one who fired the two shots. The police chief then established what he called a critical incident review committee to investigate the entire matter from an administrative standpoint. The review committee took a long time, took 11 months, and submitted a written report to the chief. The end result was that Lohman was not disciplined for his actions with respect to the shooting. However, throughout all of this process, Lohman and his history became the focus of a lot of attention, not only by this review commission, but also by the media. And one of the things that turned up is that Lohman had previously been a police officer in a small town, City of Independence, Ohio, and had resigned from his job with Independence. And the question became, why? Why had he resigned? The city then goes back over all of its paperwork that is attendant to Lohman's hiring, and in particular, it focuses on a document he completed, something known as a personal history statement, and the city ended up concluding that Lohman had been dishonest in the application process. The city then fired Lohman, not for anything to do theoretically with Tamir Rice, but instead having to do with his dishonesty in the application process. Lohman's union, which is the Cleveland Police Patrolmen's Association, challenged the termination in arbitration. And an arbitrator very recently upheld the termination. It's a very curious arbitrator's opinion. It's curious for some of the things that it says, and it's also curious for a level of analysis in which it does not engage. Although the arbitrator's opinion does deal with one of the two fundamental questions you have in these application dishonesty cases, he doesn't ever even address the second of the two questions you commonly have. So let's dive into the arbitrator's opinion, and I'll try to pick the thing apart for you. So the arbitrator begins his opinion with a very unusual caveat, one I don't think I've ever seen the likes of in an arbitration opinion before. I'm going to read it to you. It's about 3-4 lines long, and it's interesting that the arbitrator actually starts with this. Here's what the arbitrator said. Despite the national and international attention the deadly force incident of 22 November 2014 has garnered over time, this arbitrator would like to be very clear that this opinion and award is neither influenced nor impacted by public opinion, perceived political correctness from either side of the spectrum, the media's interpretation of past events, or the opinions, thoughts, and beliefs of any individual, their representatives, or any other third party. Period. It's quite a sentence. It is undisputed that the Sheriff's Office, the Prosecutor's Office, the Bureau of Criminal Identification and Investigation, a grand jury, the Cleveland Division of Police Internal Affairs Unit, and the Ad Hoc Critical Incident Review Committee all concluded that Lohman did not act criminally or violate any rule regarding his conduct. So this case, the arbitrator says, is not about Tamir Rice, not about that incident. Then the arbitrator goes on to uphold the termination, finding that Lohman had been dishonest in the application process. And it wasn't that he ended up concluding that Lohman had been actively dishonest, but rather, my phrase, not his, that he had been passively dishonest. So what is it that Lohman did? Lohman, when he worked for the Independence Police Department, he didn't last very long there. And during the field training process, he experienced a series of incidents that led his supervisors to conclude that he lacked, and I'm quoting, the maturity and emotional stability to be a police officer. We don't know what those incidents are. The arbitrator doesn't detail them at all in the arbitrator's opinion. But the arbitrator says those incidents led Independence to conclude that Lohman wasn't suitable for employment as a police officer. And so what did they do? They offered him the opportunity to resign in lieu of formal discharge. Lohman jumped at that opportunity, sent a resignation letter in, indicating that he was resigning for personal reasons. Then Lohman applies for police officer positions in various other agencies, including Cleveland. And in his employment applications for those agencies, he consistently listed personal reasons as the basis for his departure from Independence. And in the Cleveland application, he actually ends up having to sign something that is notarized. I guess this is a standard process in Cleveland, saying that everything he answered in his personal history statement was honest, and he had to sign that under oath. The arbitrator said the omission of the fact that he resigned in lieu of termination was the equivalent of dishonesty. So here's the arbitrator again. While Lohman's responses were technically correct, in that he did not overtly lie or provide false information, it is apparent that Lohman omitted certain facts that he knew or at least suspected would jeopardize his future employment as a police officer. It is evident that Lohman was confronted with a moral dilemma. Provide detailed information explaining the reasons for his departure from Independence and jeopardize future employment opportunities, or provide as little information as possible regarding the reason for his departure in the hope it would go unnoticed or he'd get a foot in the door. Lohman chose the latter. The arbitrator ends up concluding that if, in fact, Lohman had disclosed what had really gone on in Independence, the city would not have hired him, and that Lohman reasonably believed that. And as a result, the arbitrator ends up saying he was dishonest, and dishonesty is a terminable offense, and therefore I, the arbitrator, am upholding the termination. All right, so how does this case match up against others of the that you can think of in the broad category as application dishonesty cases? And there's, as I mentioned at the outset of this discussion, there's really two issues you see arbitrators and courts looking at with respect to these types of cases. And the first issue is one that the arbitrator in Lohman's case does look at, and that is, if there's dishonesty in the application process, then once the employer discovers the dishonesty, it can take action, even though it may be weeks or months or years, one case I can think of, more than a decade after the individual has hired onto the job. The analysis is, look, if you've lied in the application process, you've committed a fraud. And the contract to hire you, that you become a firefighter or a police officer, a corrections officer for this agency, that contract was only made because of your fraud. And once the employer has discovered that, it can undo that contract. And so that part of the equation here, this arbitrator, I think, gets quite right. This is the way courts and arbitrators look at these dishonesty sorts of issues. But the arbitrator doesn't go into the other half of the analysis. It's the other half of the analysis. Arbitrators very often in these cases will look at an employer and say, yeah, you can undo the hiring decision, but you have to establish something. You have to establish that you could not have discovered this dishonesty with a reasonable effort on your part. So how would that all play out in Lohman's case? Well, it's reasonable, I think, that when a law enforcement agency is contemplating hiring a police officer, it's A, going to do a background investigation, and B, actually talk to the prior employers of the candidate before making the decision. There's no discussion of that in this arbitrator's opinion. Did the city go out and talk to the police chief and whoever was in the field training program in Independence? We just don't know. There's no suggestion as to whether or not they did or they didn't. If, in fact, the city did not do that, most arbitrators wouldn't uphold a termination in this case. And so it's a kind of a conspicuous lack in this arbitrator's opinion of analysis of a critical issue that you see in many of these cases. So, interesting case. I'm not ultimately convinced that this case is uninfluenced by politics because of that critical lack in the arbitrator's opinion. But, like all arbitration opinions, it's final and binding. I saw a news story that the Cleveland Police Patrolmen's Association is going to challenge the arbitrator's decision. That's going to be an uphill battle for them. Ohio is pretty strict about upholding arbitrators' decisions and pretty much would be insisting that the association make some sort of showing of fraud on the part of the arbitrator. That's going to be a very long haul. I would expect this arbitrator's opinion will be upheld. Now I want to talk about this duty of fair representation case that comes out of Michigan. Let me get through the facts really quickly, and then I want to get into the significance of the decision in terms of its description of the duty of fair representation. So this is a case involving a deputy sheriff. Her name is Antoinette Lloyd. She works for the Wayne County Sheriff's Department in Michigan, and she filed a duty of fair representation unfair labor practice complaint with Michigan's Employment Relations Commission, saying that the union, the association, had wrongly declined to pursue her grievance. What was her grievance? It came out of a 2015 promotional examination. Lloyd took the exam. She was placed on a promotional list. In 2017, the county scheduled a new exam. This is for the position of sergeant. Created a new promotional list. And the last promotion that the county made from the 2015 list was in June of 2017. And after that, it began using the 2017 list. Nothing unusual in any of that, right? Promotional lists expire. People die on the list. Lloyd apparently died on this list. What Lloyd is arguing is that the association's contract with the county prohibited the county from promoting from a new list unless a sufficient number of deputies had been promoted from the old list. Lloyd made this argument to the county, which wasn't interested in it, and then went to the association's executive board and made her pitch. And the association decided not to file a grievance, and Lloyd filed the unfair labor practice complaint. And that's what goes to the Employment Relations Commission. By the way, just an aside for a moment, unfair labor practice complaints around the country are handled, dealing with the duty of fair representation in particular, are handled differently under different jurisdictions. So, for example, in some states, Washington is a good example, this complaint could have been filed in court in addition to being filed before the Labor Board in Washington, which is the Public Employment Relations Commission. In other places, this sort of duty of fair representation claim can only be filed in court. Most places, though, like in Michigan, it can only be filed with the Labor Board. All of that is just simply a practice tip. Check if you're dealing with a duty of fair representation claim, check and see whether or not the claim is filed in the right place, because from time to time, they are not filed in the right place. And by the way, while I'm off on a tangent, let me go off on that. Employers need to be concerned about the duty of fair representation, as well as unions. To be sure, it's unions that are primarily responsible for damages associated with breaches of the duty of fair representation. However, if you think about it, if the duty of fair rep claim is that the union has failed to pursue a grievance, what kind of remedy can the employee get in many cases, where it's only the employer that has the ability to give the remedy? Like in Lloyd's case, the union can't promote anybody. It's only the employer that can promote someone. And say, for example, she had been terminated and was challenging her termination to her grievance. Well, the union can't overturn a termination. That's the employer. So employers are necessary parties in these duty of fair representation cases, because they're necessary to be in the case in order to have an effective remedy. So it's actually in an employer's best interest to make sure that a union is dotting the I's and crossing the T's on the duty of fair representation, so the employer doesn't have to go out and spend money defending against the duty of fair representation claim. All right, I'm back off at the tangent now. How does the Employment Relations Commission deal with Lloyd's complaint? And it starts by saying three things that I think are very important. The court says, look, here's what the scope is of the duty of fair representation. Here are the responsibilities that a union has, and there's three of them. First of all, to serve the interests of all members without hostility or discrimination towards any. Now, let me pause on that. The duty of fair representation actually was created by the Supreme Court out of whole cloth in the 1940s, and it has anti-discrimination roots. It came out of cases in the railroads where the seniority systems in some of the unions gave preference to whites over blacks. So there's an anti-discrimination component to the duty of fair representation that has come forward to the present time. It's gone way beyond race discrimination. And this is just broadly discrimination in the sense of treating two otherwise similarly situated individuals differently. But that's where that discrimination comes from. Okay, so the commission says you got three responsibilities, unions. One, serve all members without hostility or discrimination. Two, exercise your discretion in complete good faith and honesty. And third, avoid arbitrary conduct. A union is guilty of bad faith, the commission says, when it acts with, and I'm going to quote here, improper intent, purpose, or motive, such as fraud, dishonesty, or other intentionally misleading conduct. So that's the setup. Those are the three rules that unions have to follow. No discrimination, act in good faith, and avoid arbitrary conduct. And it's only when the union goes beyond that it acts in a way that is wholly irrational or is guilty of gross negligence that the union breaches its duty of fair representation. And the commission says That's not the case here. It's true. Lloyd had one interpretation of the contract. The association had another interpretation of the contract. That's fine. That is within the union's discretion to have a different interpretation of the labor agreement. And the commission goes on to say, look, we don't determine which party's position on the interpretation of the contract is right. We don't impose on the union an obligation to prove that the member is wrong. Rather, and I'm going to quote again, the union is allowed to exercise its discretion as long as its decision is within the range of reasonableness. And this was. So, no breach of a duty of fair representation. All right, so what is the significance of this case? This case, I think, is a real good reminder to unions out there about what the confines of the duty of fair representation are and what they aren't. And just a few things I want to tack on to the commission's opinion here. First of all, our advice in our law firm to unions about the duty of fair representation has been very consistent. We've never had a client successfully sued for breach of duty of fair representation, not in the 40 years I've been doing this work. And in fact, we've only had one claim ever in all of that time, and it was dismissed. What's our advice? Establish fair procedures and follow them in every case. Do the same thing in every case. Fair procedures with respect to a grievance should probably involve listening to the member, giving the member an opportunity to address whoever the grievance decision maker is. So let the person come to the executive board, as happened in Lloyd's case. It should probably involve allowing the member, if they want to bring in an advocate. I know a lot of unions bristle at the notion of a member showing up with her or his own attorney, but like, why not? Why not give them the chance to make their pitch as aided as you can possibly be? Make sure that your procedures involve disqualifying decision makers. If they have a conflict of interest, you don't want them participating in the case. They need to recuse themselves from the case. And if you follow those procedures, or procedures like those, fair procedures, then a union is going to be insulated from liability against breach of duty of fair representation. If unions follow correct procedures, they have the right to be wrong in assessing the merits of a grievance. They have the right to take into account ancillary considerations, like the cost of pursuing the grievance, the cost of the membership of adverse precedents that may come out of the grievance, the fact that some other members might be harmed by a granting or denial of the grievance. I mean, that's true in every seniority case, right? There's winners and losers in every single seniority situation. Unions can take all of that stuff and more into account in making their decision, so long as their procedures are correct and they're not acting in a discriminatory or arbitrary manner. One last point about the duty of fair representation. You can get insurance for it. There are several insurance companies that that issue duty of fair representation coverage. Sometimes it's done through officers and directors coverage, and sometimes it's just specifically duty of fair representation coverage. One thing I want to mention to you about that coverage, I think every single time I've read one of those policies, there's a rider, and the rider allows the union to buy extra insurance for its members of its executive board or its officers. And that extra insurance, if you've ever been presented with it, you'd look at it and say, wow, what a bargain. This only costs $100 a year, whatever it is. It's much less than the duty of fair representation coverage. Well, we should get it. Why does it cost that little? It costs that little because courts have consistently ruled that it is only the union that owes a duty of fair representation. Union officers, union board members don't have that duty and can't be sued for breach of duty of fair representation. So that's why the coverage is so cheap, is because it's covering for a non-risk. So think twice before buying that rider. Save yourself, enough money for whatever, Christmas bonus for somebody. Let's go over to Nebraska now for our last case, the body camera case. Nebraska, I think, wins the contest for what is the most unusual name for a state labor board. In Nebraska, it's not a PERB or a PERC or an ERB or, anything that says Employee Relations Board or anything like that. Nebraska, the labor board is called the Commission on Industrial Relations. Some point in time, I'm actually going to have to spend a few minutes on Google and figure out what the origins of that are. There's no other state that has a Commission on Industrial Relations. Now, however, CIR, as it's known in Nebraska, acts pretty much like a standard state labor board, and Nebraska has binding arbitration for public safety employees. The binding arbitration is done through CIR, and CIR also handles unfair labor practice complaints. And that's what this one was, is an unfair labor practice complaint. This involves corrections officers. And they are all represented in Nebraska, or the ones who work for the state of Nebraska are represented by AFSCME, Local 61 of AFSCME. There's a collective bargaining agreement in place. It has a management rights clause. That's going to play a role in this case. The management rights clause grants the state, and I'm quoting, the right to introduce new or improved methods, equipment, technology, or facilities. Focus on that equipment and technology. It's a management right to introduce equipment and technology. All right, what goes on? This comes out of the Tecumseh State Correctional Institution 2017. A major at the institution gives notice that effective August 28th, body-worn cameras would be used at three locations in the institution, and that other housing units within the institution, employees who work there, would be given body cameras at a later time. When the department actually put the body cameras in use, Local 61 of AFSCME filed an unfair labor practice complaint saying, hey, you have to bargain over the impact of the usage of body cameras. Let me pause for a moment there. I don't know what it is. Maybe first podcast of the year. I'm kind of being critical of people here, so I'll go ahead and do it, I guess. Notice that I said that the unfair labor practice complaint was filed when the department put the body cameras in use. If you're a union, that should make you a little bit nervous. Typically, a state labor board will say that unions have to act in a timely fashion in raising bargaining issues, in pointing out that a midterm change in whatever policy or procedure it is impacts wages, hours, or working conditions and has to be negotiated. If a union sits on its rights for too long, it's not going to be able to file an unfair labor practice complaint. That's something that labor boards called waiver by inaction. The whole idea is the union needs to act as quickly as possible so that bargaining can occur, and bargaining can occur in a timely fashion. So when does the clock start ticking on the issue of a union having to demand the right to bargain? Labor boards around the country are pretty consistent. It starts ticking when the union gets notice of an intended change, not when the change itself occurs. So unions should not be waiting. If they've heard, for example, from the major at Tecumseh State Correctional Institution that body cameras are going to be implemented, in the future, the union shouldn't wait until the body cameras are actually implemented. That announcement by the major, that triggers the union's bargaining rights. Okay. That wasn't an issue raised in this case, but it just really stuck out at me. So what does Nebraska's CIR do with this particular case? The commission ends up saying that body cameras are mandatory for bargaining, or at least the impact of them are mandatory for bargaining. Why? What's the rationale? The CIR turns to National Labor Relations Board cases. And there are no NLRB body camera cases, but there's plenty of NLRB surveillance camera cases. And the NLRB has found, going back 20 years, that if you put a surveillance camera in the workplace, it is analogous to physical examinations, drug and alcohol testing requirements, and polygraph testing, all of which the NLRB has found to be mandatory for bargaining. All of these things, say the NLRB, drug testing and surveillance cameras and physical examinations, all of them are investigatory tools or methods that are used by employers to determine if employees have engaged in misconduct. So CIR takes a look at all of that and says, okay, that seems to tell us that body cameras are in fact mandatory for bargaining. The state argues, though, look, that's not the reason we're implementing body cameras. The reason we're implementing body cameras is for safety and for use in controlling inmates and recording interactions with inmates. CIR says, you know, that's true, but that doesn't mean you can't use them for purposes, other purposes, in particular that you can't use them for employee discipline. And CIR cites the testimony of a warden that recordings from the cameras could and would be used to support disciplinary action against employees. And here's the conclusion of the CIR's opinion, just only two lines wrong here. CIR says, the state argues that the body cameras are simply an extension of the fixed cameras at the facility that already record inmate interactions and therefore are not a mandatory subject to bargaining. We disagree with that argument. We find that the usage of body-worn cameras unilaterally implemented by the state would vitally affect the terms and conditions of employment and are therefore a mandatory subject of bargaining. All right. Another case holding that body cameras are mandatory for bargaining. The record here is getting to be quite a long one. It started with Oklahoma City, moved to Montgomery County, Maryland. There have been decisions in various other states around the country, most notably one out of the city of Chicago before the Illinois Labor Relations Board. And with one exception, all of those decisions around the country have found that body cameras are mandatory for bargaining. The one exception is a case out of Denver, but Denver doesn't bargain under a normal bargaining law. It bargains under a local ordinance that very narrowly describes what is negotiable, and body cameras are not negotiable under that narrowly drawn ordinance. So by now, seems very clear, the imposition or substantial amendments to a body camera system are going to be considered by a labor board to be a mandatory subject of bargaining and must be negotiated before the body cameras are actually placed into use. Okay, that's it for our first podcast of 2019. Hope to see you at an upcoming LRIS seminar. And a reminder, go to our webpage and check out the new subscription program that we have and consider subscribing to our premium podcasts. With that, this is Will Aitchison signing off.